Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. We recently asked our listeners for topics that they would like us to cover on the show, and one of the requests was for a discussion of banned books. Although the U.S. government doesn't censor or ban books outright, according to Mark Crispin Miller, a professor of media studies at NYU, publishers are often pressured to bury books on sensitive issues like abortion, organized crime, the CIA, and financial inequality. And he has curated a series published by Open Road Media called Forbidden Bookshelf, in which he has resurrected hard-to-find books on some of these subjects. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show now to discuss them. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me on.
You began publishing this series about 5 years ago. What inspired you to start it?
That's a good question. There were really 2 things that inspired me to do this series. One was that I had noticed over the years as a professor that certain titles that I wanted to assign my classes were gone. They were missing.
Were they out of print or
to
find?
They were out of print. Often these are books that hadn't been published that long since, right? But they had kind of vanished. And, this was, I guess I started noticing this in the 80s, so it was before the internet at least made it possible to buy used copies here and there. And I also noticed half-consciously over the years that this list of books that I couldn't find was growing, right?
Well, we usually assume that if it's out of print, it's because there weren't really great sales during the first edition, so the publisher just didn't bother printing anymore.
Well, that's part of it in some cases. I did a big piece about the book publishing industry for The Nation back in the 90s, and one of the things I discovered there was that the Supreme Court had basically ruled that back copies of books are comparable to machine parts, and therefore publishers could no longer write off the expense of warehousing them. So this glitch in the tax laws actually led to the pulping of many, many backlists. So now the major corporate publishers don't even maintain backlists. So, there were a number of reasons why these books were gone. But the fact is, too many of them, as far as I was concerned, were gone and deserved to be revived. And then the other motivation in my case was a little more dramatic. I myself wrote a book that came out in 2005 called Fooled Again, which is about the theft of the 2004 election. And this is a book that was published by a major publisher, Basic Books. They put everything they had behind it. And they could not get any publicity for the book. They tried and tried. They ran into a brick wall. I even went so far as to hire my own publicist, an eminent publicist, who, with the best will in the world, really tried to break through, and it was impossible.
You would have thought they would have wanted to reissue it after the last election.
Well,
because
much
of the same story, wasn't it?
Well, that is a very good question, which I'd like to return to.
Okay,
the fact
later.
Of the matter is, I learned the hard way that election theft in the United States is one of a significant number of subjects that really are taboo. You can't really publish anything about them and get any traction. And you actually look into them at considerable professional peril if you're a reporter, if you're a professor. All right. We'll return to the question of election theft because one of the forbidden books...
Yeah, but why peril? I mean, after all, if you're a tenured professor, let's say, you can pretty much publish anything you want. In fact, they kind of want you to publish things. And if you're publishing something that's original, isn't that appreciated?
Well, that's a touchingly naive question.
Yeah, well.
I mean, of course they want you to publish.
Or perish.
But the fact is that you don't want to be tagged as a conspiracy theorist. You don't want to be tagged as a crackpot. And we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, but one of the many ways in which books have been killed is unsympathetic reviewers are clearly tasked with defining these books as crackpot books. And they're not. They're not crackpot books. They're, I mean, I can say, you could, I'm sitting here in front of you. I think you would agree that I don't look crazy. Fooled Again was a very carefully researched study of the 2004 election, and it got no reviews. And I was actually reviled as a conspiracy theorist, mostly in left publications. The corporate media ignored it. So to answer your opening question, I had really two reasons for deciding to start the Forbidden Bookshelf. One was that as a professor, I wanted to have readier access to books my students ought to read. And my personal reason was I had discovered that you really are taking a kind of risk to tackle certain subjects as a writer. And a significant number of the books that are in the series had done precisely that.
And we'll talk about a number of them. Didn't your parents own a small publishing company in Chicago? What kinds of books did they publish?
Oh, yeah. Well, my mother was passed away last summer, and my father ran a very well-respected small publishing company called Academy Chicago. My mother was kind of a pioneer as a woman running a book publishing company that paid particular attention to women's issues. They did a lot of George Sand. And at my suggestion, I guess this is to combine the subjects we're discussing now, they did publish the Conyers Report after the 2004 election, which was a report on what had happened in Ohio to the vote at Republican hands, written by the Democratic members of the House Judiciary Committee. And this was a very important study of all the kinds of tactics used to depress the Democratic vote in that election. And that report had essentially been blacked out by the corporate media. And I urged them to publish it, and they did. It had an introduction by Gore Vidal. So that was, you know, one time when they kind of strayed into my prospective territory. For the most part, they did a lot of fiction. Nonfiction, mostly of a kind of non-political character. So I guess you could say that book publishing runs in the family in my case.
There can be another book. Maybe there is already a book in the works on suppression of voters, because that was a big story in the newspapers this year.
Yeah,
does it matter whether it's a news story if the papers report on it?
No, it ought to, but it doesn't. But, you know, aside from the fact that you know, it matters whether the press pays attention to something. I think you could probably say that in a democracy, objectively speaking, the sanctity of the vote, the will of the electorate, are things that really should be at the forefront of everybody's mind. The press should be looking into it. Scholars should be studying these things. One of the books in the Forbidden Bookshelf series is an indispensable read for anyone who wants to grasp the problem of election theft in this country. It's called Vote Scam by James Collier and Kenneth Collier, a couple of brothers who wrote an account of how one of them, who had run for the House in Florida in the early 70s, had been robbed of a considerable number of votes. It was actually, in that case, Claude Pepper, a Democrat, whose team had managed the chicanery. And they set about for the next couple of decades to look into how votes were being stolen on a vast scale.
And that was published in 1992. So
yeah,
this
self-published.
Is something
self-published.
Ah.
Yeah, they couldn't find a publisher for this book. And it is not only about the actual theft of the votes, Leonard, but it also notes in passing all the major media outlets that refuse to go near this subject, liberal, conservative. It really makes no difference. Across the board, the media shunned this story. Outfits and outlets that promised to look into it suddenly changed their minds. It is really a staggering story. And I have to say that when I wrote my own book on the theft of the 2004 election, I had not even heard of this book. It had never come to my attention. And that is an indication of how successfully and completely you can actually erase a book once it's come out.
So how do you discover these books? Do people call you and say, I have a book for you?
Well, now that happens. I hear from people all the time who call my attention to books that we should be considering for the series. But I had come to know about a number of books and their fates. DuPont, Behind the Nylon Curtain by Gerald Colby, was a book whose fate was probably the most notorious. That's the book whose own publisher, Prentice Hall, actually colluded or was forced to collude with the DuPont family to kill the book by suddenly cutting the print run down by a third so that it could not possibly make any money. Colby tells the whole story in the new introduction to the book that we have brought back, Behind the Nylon Curtain.
And is that book about the DuPont family as much as about the DuPont business practices?
It is a massive history of the DuPont dynasty and their business practices. It is an encyclopedic and yet riveting overview of the history of one of the most influential families in American history. If any family merits being called a collective member of the secret elite, it would be the DuPonts. And the story of how they managed to kill this book not once but twice is in itself staggering. Let me just quickly say that after Prentice Hall helped to kill the book and Colby ended up suing them and the DuPonts, and of course the lawsuit went nowhere because the tentacles of the DuPonts reach into the federal bench, Lyle Stewart, a legendarily feisty publisher, agreed to do a second edition. This is about 10 years later. And to everyone's amazement, the 30 pages of the new edition in which Colby tells the story of the suppression of the first edition, those 30 pages were somehow missing from a significant number of the books in that print run. They were damaged. They had to be recalled. So again, Stewart ended up not being able to sell enough books to make a profit.
They were damaged?
Yeah, they were damaged. They were inexplicably damaged. I mean, you're talking about a family as powerful as the mafia, say, and with as many means at its disposal to do what it wants to do. And I think that when interests like the DuPonts, just for example, wield that kind of power on the free speech of its would-be critics, you have a system in which the notion of free speech is kind of a mockery, you know. And that's just one family.
So you could tell these stories with new introductions to these books.
Yes, most of the. Let me make clear to your listeners that these new editions of these books are e-books, right? Mm-hmm. That was the only way that was economically feasible to do them. And most of them have new introductions, either by the authors or by others, you know, in the cases where the authors are no longer with us.
Well, the book business has changed quite a bit in recent years. We now have e-books, audio books, self-published books, and bookstores are struggling to survive. Mm-hmm. So e-books is just the easiest way to get past all of those problems. How do people find the e-books on Amazon?
Well, yes, you can go to Amazon, although Amazon is a major reason why the book business and bookstores in particular are in such trouble. Nevertheless, I don't want to badmouth them if they make the titles in our series available.
But we can only wonder if somebody writes an expose of Amazon whether Amazon would squelch it or not.
Yeah, I don't think you have to wonder. I think the answer to that question is
it's already
yes.
happened?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of stuff online about Amazon's business practices and Google's algorithms and so on, and Facebook, right? Mm-hmm. Wherever you have private entities with so much cultural influence, right, you necessarily have a situation in which it is next to impossible to criticize them and have anybody hear you, right? So, but I mean, we could talk about free speech per se, but I expect we will continue to do so. But the fact is that if people want to take a look at the 27 or so titles in the series, they can just go forbiddenbookshelf.com. That's the publisher's list of all the titles and their introducers and my introduction to the series.
You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. My guest is Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media studies at NYU and the publisher of the Open Road Media's series Forbidden Bookshelf. Over the years, some novels that were banned in certain places were because they were deemed obscene or blasphemous. Now they're considered classics. So James Joyce's Ulysses and Nabokov's Lolita. Although I've been told by some teachers that in classes where they want to teach Lolita, the students sometimes object. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, earlier Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn. We're not talking about those books, but was the process similar?
No, I'm glad you brought that up, because when you say banned books, people immediately think of those examples, books that have been deemed obscene, irreligious, and so on, books that have been banned in a regional way, right, that certain school boards will take copies off the shelves. And this is a kind of a rallying point for many liberal activists. They deplore this kind of overt suppression. To my mind, I mean, that's regrettable. I don't approve of that at all. I mean, I'm kind of an ardent libertarian. I think everything should be available. But what we're talking about here is something completely different. You know, there's no danger of Huckleberry Finn or To Kill a Mockingbird or Catcher in the Rye or The Color Purple disappearing, you know, going out of print. And in fact, if anything, those kinds of random bans are marketing advantages. I mean,
they spur sales.
Yeah, they spur sales. People want to see what's forbidden to them, especially if there's some hint that it has to do with obscenity, and people get, oh, I want to read that. You know, it sounds hot. I'm talking about books that never, ever rise to the level of visibility where people even know they exist, right?
And so your series consists mainly of nonfiction works on American history, politics, social issues, and many of them were originally published 25, 50, even 80 years ago. But you think they all remain relevant?
Yeah, I think they all remain relevant, or we would not have brought them back. In fact, the oldest book in the series, The Lords of Creation by Frederick Lewis Allen, came out in 1935, appears to be our biggest seller, interestingly enough. Frederick Lewis Allen was a best-selling author in his day, mm-hmm. and was the author of a very popular book called Born Yesterday, but I'm blanking on the correct title. But those other books, those sort of popular histories of the past that he wrote, have remained in print since he first wrote them decades ago. But this one about J.P. Morgan and the financialization of the American economy and the deliberate engineering of the boom and bust cycle. Okay, this is the one that...
This follows the Depression, the Great Depression.
During the Depression, right? The book...
Oh, yeah, 1935.
Right. This is the book of his that vanished, that slipped out of print. The introduction to our edition is by Gretchen Morgenson, a great financial reporter for The New York Times, now at The Wall Street Journal. And she nails it in her introduction, pointing out that what Allen... The history that Allen gives us it marks the origin of the economic moment we live in today. So even though it is, you know, considerably older than our other titles, it seems to have lost none of its relevance. And as I say, it's our biggest seller so far.
And its title is The Lords of Creation, subtitled The History of America's 1%. Were people already talking about 1% in 1935?
No, they weren't.
This is something you've added
this
since?
Is my, I took the liberty as editor of the series to give it that subtitle.
Now I'm going to ask you this question pretty much about every one of these books. How was it suppressed?
Well, I already explained in the case of Behind the Nylon Curtain how that book was actually physically damaged. Well, at first, in the first edition, the Prentice Hall editors were evidently pressured into cutting the print run by a third. Mm-hmm. And then there was some kind of industrial sabotage involving the second one, right? And that, and this despite the fact, to bring up something you noted at the beginning of the conversation, that the press reviews generally of Behind the Nylon Curtain were glowing, very positive. That made no difference, that the DuPont family swung into action and through various means managed to make the book disappear. Another one of our successful titles, The Phoenix Program by Douglas Valentine, is a magisterial study of this appalling 7-year-long CIA assassination and torture program that was highly controversial during the Vietnam War. Doug Valentine got access to a number of former CIA officers who reminisced for him about their work on this program. And as he was doing his research, the CIA got wind of what he was doing and the attitude he was going to take, or I should say the approach he was going to take. And they actually started to withhold documents from him. They balked his attempts to use the Freedom of Information Act to get a lot of crucial documents. And they spread the word that people in the CIA and other agencies of the government should not talk to him.
It was about the CIA's use of torture, kidnapping, and assassination to destabilize the Viet Cong.
To degrade Viet Cong infrastructure was the euphemism they used. But they basically ended up murdering between 20 and 40,000 South Vietnamese civilians.
And this was information that was not available until they came up with it, until Douglas Valentine came up with it?
He was the one who revealed most about the bureaucratic underpinnings of this program. Nobody else had, I mean, it was reported glancingly in the press. And in fact, William Colby of the CIA had to sort of answer for it before the Senate, you know, during hearings and sort of apologize for it. But it was Valentine who has told the story most comprehensively. And what I'm telling you is, in answer to your question, how are these books suppressed? The CIA energetically interfered with his completion of the project. He had to sue them with the help of the ACLU to stop interfering. He finished the book. And then Morley Safer of CBS News wrote an extremely negative short review in the Times Book Review. I think I can quote from memory something. This is as turgid and dense and often incomprehensible a book as I have ever had the misfortune to read.
Whoa.
And it was really damning. Completely wrong, okay? But he was clearly functioning as a kind of hitman for the agency, as many journalists have done. And this review moved St. Martin's Press to stop putting any money into the book, canceling a paperback deal. Okay, so the book, it was killed because of this review after failed attempts actually to thwart its completion.
You're suggesting that the New York Times Book Review has incredible power, and if somebody gives a book a bad review, even if it's a great book, there's a good chance that book is going to fail.
Well, that was the case formerly. It's not so anymore because the landscape has changed so radically. But yeah, back in the day, a New York Times review was decisive with books as with Broadway shows, you know.
There's another book, The Hidden History of the Korean War, 1950-51, by I.F. Stone, obviously a very well-known journalist. Why was that book suppressed?
Oh, brother. Yeah, Stone.
Although Izzy Stone's writing career was always a bit troubled.
Well, it was especially troubled after this book came out. I mean, he was an unabashedly left-wing journalist, but he did have some latitude until this book came out to write for fairly mainstream publications. What he did was basically write an authoritative history of how the Korean War began, and more importantly, how General Douglas MacArthur and the nascent military-industrial complex protracted it, prolonged it, for the sake of profits and in order to get the military-industrial complex up and running. Stone also did not flinch from talking about the atrocious practices of the American military in North Vietnam, the use of napalm, completely devastating villages, you know, with tremendous amounts of air power, you know. The book came out before the war was really even over. Let me say that he could not find a publisher to take the book. I mean, I think something like 30 publishers turned it down. Finally, the Monthly Review Press agreed to do it. This is an independent leftist outfit. I think they still exist. And that was it for I.F. Stone for the next 17 years.
Although, ironically, the president of the United States at that time, Dwight D. Eisenhower, gave a famous speech warning us against the power of the military-industrial complex.
Indeed, he did, just before leaving office. That didn't do I.F. Stone any good, though. No, I mean, he was banished. You know, the reason why we know of I.F. Stone as the publisher of I.F. Stone's Weekly, the reason why he had to turn to self-publication for the next 20 years or so is precisely because of this book, The Hidden History of the Korean War, basically got him exiled from polite intellectual society. And he didn't really reemerge from, I should say, return from this exile for years afterwards. And then the book, you know, was briefly republished, and then that disappeared. So our edition of The Hidden History of the Korean War, it has a great introduction by Bruce Cummings of the University of Chicago. And let me say something important here. I mean, I think it's important. You know, now we often hear about North Korea and Trump and, you know, negotiations over their nuclear program and so on. I feel safe in saying that just about everybody's understanding of where North Korea is coming from vis-a-vis the United States is lacking, right? Because precisely because of the disappearance of books like I.F. Stone's, you know, when you disappear books, right? When you make them unavailable, you make them not just unavailable, but make it so that people don't even know they've ever come out. What you're actually doing is ensuring that people's minds are like voids when it comes to crucially important historical information that they should have, right? So in a sense, you know, we're talking about the kind of Orwellian vision of determining what people think about the present by erasing a staggering number of books, crucial books about the past. And that applies to the Phoenix program as well. And in his new introduction to our edition, Doug Valentine talks about the Phoenix program as a template for the way that the U.S. military and CIA have continued to operate all over the world. In other words, it's not just a historical account of something that happened during the Vietnam War. It is an account of the formation of a kind of template for how the U.S. military and the CIA would continue to operate and have continued to operate, okay? There was a piece in the New York Times recently, an uncharacteristically relevant and useful piece, I might say, about what CIA-led Afghan soldiers have been doing in Afghanistan, you know, atrocious violation of human rights. That, to anyone who's read the Phoenix program, that is a familiar story. And I wrote to Doug, and I said, isn't it true that what we have just read in the New York Times about Afghanistan, we're talking about the Phoenix program all over again? And he wrote back and said, absolutely, that's Phoenix. It's there. It's in Iraq. It was in Nicaragua. You know, it was in all these places. So what we're talking about with the Forbidden Bookshelf is an effort to try to restore or discover crucial history that has been blacked out precisely through suppressive efforts like the ones we're talking about today.
But there is another I.F. Stone book on your list, Underground to Palestine and Other Writing on Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East. Is this his account of the exodus of Holocaust survivors from Europe to what became the State of Israel?
It isn't exactly that. It's a much more focused personal diary of his journey to Palestine. That volume, let me say.
When was that published?
That was published in the 40s, before the creation of the State of Israel. And it is actually a collection of all his writings on Israel from that time, edited by T.D. Guttenplan, who wrote American Radical.
He's been a guest on our show recently.
Right. Okay. Well, he did a great job. Speaking of Israel and Palestine, I want to mention another title in the series. I mean, talk about taboo subjects, right? I mean, it's very difficult to criticize Israeli policy or the occupation. I'm very proud, therefore, to have been able to acquire the rights to a book by Moshe Menuhin. This is the father of the great violinist Yehudi Menuhin. Moshe Menuhin was a lifelong, staunch anti-Zionist, whose anti-Zionism was squarely based on his Jewish piety. On the basis of the prophetic teachings of the Bible, he believed that Zionism is a betrayal of Judaism. And in 1965, he wrote a masterful history and critique of Zionism that, needless to say, no publisher would touch, that was finally published by the Institute for Palestine Studies, okay? This is in 65. No one has ever even heard of this book, and it is an excellent book, and I think a crucial introduction to the whole subject of Zionism, and a book that can't be dismissed as the work of an anti-Semite, obviously.
In fact, there are a number of other groups in Israel who believe that Zionism is a mistake.
But well, that's right. Many Orthodox Jews believe this, but the point is, this is a book written for the general reader, okay? And so I was very eager for us to include it in the series. We gave it a new title because Menuhin's title was unfortunate. It's not by might nor by power, okay, which is, from the Old Testament, the Zionist betrayal of Judaism. And this is strong stuff, this book.
I'm sure this is getting a lot of people
honest.
In trouble.
Well, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, it's either true or it's false, is my view. And if it's false, let it see the light of day and let people debate about it. If it's true, then we have to take account of it. But that's precisely the kind of thing we want to do in this series, is to give a hearing to important works of history, you know, no matter how troubling they may be to people's sensibilities and so on.
My guest is Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media studies at NYU. And the publisher or the curator of a series published by Open Road Media called Forbidden Bookshelf. Now, I mentioned earlier that the government doesn't suppress books outright.
Not outright.
And all of the books that we've been talking about so far have been somehow either eliminated or banned through pressure, not necessarily official pressure. Except maybe the CIA, would that be considered a government pressure?
Yeah, I would consider it government pressure, and so would Doug Valentine. I mean, the CIA is they specialize in precisely this kind of thing. I mean,
well, can't they just say you're revealing state secrets?
Well, that would apply only to authors who have worked for the government, okay? So, I mean, one group of Americans whose free speech rights have been thrown out the window are former employees of the CIA who have to submit their manuscripts to the agency for approval.
And sometimes they're vetted rather heavily.
This first happened with Victor Marchetti, who with John D. Marks wrote the CIA and the, what was it called, the CIA... And I'm blanking on the title. It's an important book about the CIA.
Not in your series?
No, because it is still in print.
Mm-hmm. So all the books in your series are not in print otherwise?
That's right. We can't publish
obviously
a book that somebody else has published.
Somebody else owns it.
That book was infamously over-vetted by the agency, and then the publisher, I think it was Random House, brought out a version of the book with all the redactions left in each copy, and there were so many white spaces and so on that it was an embarrassment for the agency, and they've had to tread a little bit more carefully since then. getting back to the question of how the CIA, here's a good example. In 1950, Little Brown, a very eminent publisher, came out with All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin. James Stewart Martin had been sent by the U.S. government to oversee the decartelization of the German economy after World War II. His mission was to break up the Nazi cartels, Farben and Krupp and the others. And he found when he got over there that he couldn't really do the work. He was unable to do the work because of pressures and interference from other players within the American government, and especially because of pressure from Wall Street. This is really a crucially important book that starts to shed light on the American financial enablers of the Nazi war machine. And as Hank Albarelli, there's an introduction to our edition by Christopher Simpson, an indispensable introduction, and then a preface.
Well, he wrote another book that in your list called Blowback.
Actually, we've done three of his books, and we'll get to those. But this is his territory, and he knows a great deal about this whole subject of American collusion with the Nazis. He wrote a great introduction to All Honorable Men. Hank Albarelli, who has written a lot about the CIA, told me, and I asked him to write a preface about his conversation with a CIA lawyer many years later, who told him casually that when All Honorable Men came out, the agency scurried out and bought up every copy available in the bookstores. And
made it into a bestseller.
Well, of a kind. And you know, this is pretty amazing because the book had actually earned a positive review in the New York Times, but nobody could find it. It was gone. It was absolutely gone. It was a disappeared book. And Martin himself sort of vanished into obscurity. I mean, his career as a writer was sort of destroyed by this, and that's the story that Chris Simpson tells in the introduction. But this is, as I say, a very important book on a subject that we know nothing about. And this brings us to Christopher Simpson's Blowback,
which is subtitled America's Recruitment of Nazis and Its Effect on the Cold War.
Yeah.
So it's about the period directly after World War II. We know about our missile program based on that kind of recruitment, but we were recruiting former Nazis for all sorts of different things.
That's absolutely, to help us out against the Soviet menace. Chris Simpson's Blowback.
They were anti-communists, so they were okay at that
point. Blowback, I think, is the best book on this subject. And interestingly, it's a book that isn't mentioned in any of the subsequent books on the same subject. Like, there's a book called Operation Paperclip, books that got positive reviews in the New York Times, are books that have, in their own way, helped to disappear. Simpson's pioneering book. Simpson, of all of them, has had the most to say on how our recruitment of Nazis during the Cold War actually helped determine Cold War foreign policy.
So how is it suppressed?
Well, here again we talk about the New York Times. Herbert Mittgang wrote a pretty positive review in the Daily Times.
You mean Donald Trump is correct about the New York Times?
Well, you know, a stop clock is right twice a day. I mean, don't get me started on that whole subject.
It's just a bad joke. I'm sorry.
No, it was actually a pretty good joke. But, you know, I think that Trump and his adversaries are, you know, basically doing something of the same thing. So, yeah, the New York Times is in a sense kind of a fake newspaper, in my view, which is not to say that Donald Trump tells the truth very often, because he doesn't. But, you know, as I say, this is material for another conversation. Let's simply say that here again, the New York Times did its usual thing. The Sunday review of Blowback was very damning. Written by Sergei Shmaiman, okay, who did not reveal in his review that his father, Alexander Shmaiman, was an extremely close ally of the pro-Nazi Romanian prelate Valerian Trifa.
Wow.
And that...
I didn't know that.
Well, yeah, it's not the kind of thing that Shmaiman ever talks about.
Because he was a very respected journalist.
Yes, indeed. But I think, you know... you know, it seems to me that ethically he was obliged to say, I have a family connection to one of the figures who comes up in this book. That didn't happen. So let's simply say that the Sunday Times had a big influence on the publisher of Blowback, right? And so they didn't put any more money into promoting it. So that's a way in which that book was disappeared.
In other cases, were the publishers threatened with legal action if they didn't pull a book, or pressured not to publish or publicize it, or give it wide distribution?
Well, we know that that kind of thing did definitely happen in the case of Behind the Nylon Curtain. Mm. Because the Book of the Month Club was gonna serialize that book back when the Book of the Month Club was extremely influential. This is back in the 70s. And they were directly pressured by DuPont family lawyers and decided not to go ahead with it. And in later court proceedings, their executives admitted that that had never happened before. It was the first time the Book of the Month Club was actually scared out of serializing a book that they wanted to do. So that kind of thing definitely happens, yeah.
One of the surprises for me was a book from the 30s by Lewis Mumford, The Culture of Cities. Lewis Mumford is one of the most famous critics of that time. I would have thought it would have been hard to suppress one of his books.
Yeah, I don't believe that book was actually suppressed. That's simply a book that ought not to have gone out of print and remains relevant today. Not every single book in the series is a book that was killed at birth, and that's one that I felt people should be able to get their hands on.
Well, a book that I think I interviewed the author on years ago is in this list, Assassination on Embassy Row by John Dinges. It's an examination of the murder of the Chilean leader Orlando Letelier. I interviewed Ariel Dorfman on it, but he's written the introduction for this edition.
Right.
Letelier was a former Chilean foreign minister, an opponent of Pinochet, and he was killed by a car bomb in Washington, D.C.
On Embassy Row, right mm-hmm. in the streets of our nation's capital.
And was the U.S. government implicated in that?
The CIA was heavily involved in that whole operation. It was carried out by Chilean spooks with the help of an American assassin named Michael Townley. And that is John Dinges and Saul Landau wrote Assassination on Embassy Row. And the book does go in considerable detail into the CIA's involvement, primarily in the cover-up of what had actually happened. And since you mentioned Trump a moment ago, I should probably note that William Barr, whom Trump has appointed our next attorney general, is kind of a CIA soldier. He participated in the cover-up of what had actually happened on Embassy Row that terrible day, along with George H.W. Bush, whose recent state funeral had everybody crying, nostalgically about what a wonderful human being it was because he wasn't Trump.
Barr was the hearings were on television this morning, in which he promised to not suppress anything. The Mueller report, for example.
Yeah, well.
Another topic that's fueled endless debate is the assassination of JFK, and you include Dallas 63, the first deep state revolt against the White House. It was written by a former UC Berkeley professor, Peter Dale Scott. What does he mean by deep state? Is it the same thing that we're hearing today?
Actually, Peter Dale Scott coined the phrase deep state. It originates with him. And he meant something very specific by it. It's used more loosely now. There is a very interesting kind of scholarly debate, going on. You're not going to find it on MSNBC, but it's over the precise nature of what the deep state is, okay? And without getting into that.
Well, mostly conservatives complain about the deep state these days. They claim that the FBI and the CIA are linked to deep state tendencies and that they are really working against the Trump administration.
Yeah, I would divide the sentence you just uttered in two. It is absolutely true that the FBI and the CIA are integral parts of the deep state. You know, whether they're actually at war with Trump, I think, is something.
I didn't say it was true. I just simply said the accusation's been made.
I'm saying that the accusation is half true, that there is a deep state.
Really?
But it's not at war with Trump. We just discussed a moment ago his appointment of William Barr as Attorney General, his approval of Gina Haspel as head of the CIA. These things suggest to me that what we're witnessing now with this presidential spectacle and the resistance screaming about it all the time is a form of pro wrestling. You know, I don't think it's a real conflict, in other words. But let's get back to Peter Dale Scott. His book in our series is actually the only one in the series that was in effect written for the series, because it's based on a manuscript from long ago that I asked him to update and expand. So Dallas 63 is actually his latest complete book on a subject he's been writing about for decades. You know, my view is the Kennedy assassination is a seminal event in all the realms that we've been discussing today. If you're talking about the deep state and its interference in American politics.
But he's not saying the deep state was responsible for the assassination.
Well, he doesn't come out and say it in precisely those words, but there's little doubt that the deep
state... Lee Harvey Oswald was working for the deep state?
Yeah, I don't think there's any real controversy over that. It is... Let me recommend another book that we didn't publish that is in print. It's a masterpiece, and your listeners should know about it, and you should read it. It's called JFK and the Unspeakable by James Douglas. This is an indispensable overview of not only the voluminous evidence that the so-called deep state, specifically the CIA, did actually kill JFK, but more importantly, it is an analysis of why he was killed. JFK was trying to dial down the Cold War. He intended to pull out of Vietnam. He had gone up against major economic interests, the steel industry and others. He was essentially a dead man because he was doing what he thought he should do as the president of the United States for the welfare of the American people and the preservation of world peace. He was a marked man for this reason. For those of us who have been studying the assassination for quite a long time, it is not even really an issue any longer whether or not we have to prove that the CIA was behind it. The evidence is fairly eloquent in itself that they were involved. And let me add that the same thing applies to the other three major assassinations of that era: the killings of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. It is only because a considerable number of really essential books have been either suppressed or defined as conspiracy theory that many of us labor under the delusion that these were not state crimes. I think it's quite clear that they were.
You also have books on Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Hoffa, Nelson Rockefeller, and three books by Dan E. Muldea that link the mob to different things: Dark Victory, Ronald Reagan, MCA, and the Mob, The Hoffa Wars, The Rise and Fall of Jimmy Hoffa, and also Interference, How Organized Crime Influences Professional Football.
Yeah, let me talk about that last one.
Because we have very little time, so...
Okay, yeah. Well, Interference is Dan's expose of the NFL's involvement with organized crime.
To this day?
Well, he wrote this book in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I doubt much has changed, but it's a terrific book. And here again, I mentioned the New York Times. Times sports writer wrote a really scurrilous review of the book, basically impugning his journalistic integrity. And he sued over this. He sued the New York Times, arguing that book reviewers should be held to the same standard of accuracy and newspapers should be held to the same standard of fact-checking integrity as reporters. And this suit found its way all the way up to the Supreme Court, where Dan lost, okay? But the fact is that here again, the Times functioned in a kind of policing capacity to do in a book that was attacking a major interest, in this case, the NFL. But I urge your listeners to get a hold of that book. It's quite good.
We haven't been able to talk about every book in the series, but people can find out about all of them on your website?
Well, they can. My website is markcrispinmiller.com. It's called News from Underground.
Mm-hmm. And, you have a newsletter, News from Underground?
What it is a listserv and then a website. Mm-hmm. And every day I send out stories that people ought to know. Sometimes I write little pieces myself. And anyone who contacts me at markcrispinmiller@gmail.com can get on the listserv. But the best way to find out about the series, per se, is to go to forbiddenbookshelf.com, which is Open Road Media's website for the series specifically. And then they can figure out how, whichever vendor they want to use to get the books.
They can also get digital editions on Overdrive, which can be accessed through the New York Public Library.
That's right, and I encourage that. I think that's
a great thing. So the New York Public Library is not censoring books. Has it ever been involved in censoring in the past?
I haven't.
I would assume that libraries sometimes refuse to buy certain books, even though they might have been of value.
Well, I think that that's undoubtedly happened in the past, but I can't say anyone's brought it to my attention in this case.
I'm assuming there are other titles coming out.
Well, actually, right now, the series is pretty much complete because, to be perfectly honest, it's been as difficult to publicize the series as it was for each of these authors to have their books publicized in the first place. And I think that shouldn't come as a surprise. So Open Road is not, at the moment, open to expanding the list any further. But I think that if people do respond to, say, this show, for example, and if the titles sell, and if we can get more publicity for the series, it will become a longer list.
In just the 2 minutes we have left, I didn't want to ignore the Dan Muldea book called Dark Victory, Ronald Reagan, MCA, and the Mob. Does the book argue that the mafia was behind Reagan's becoming president?
That book has to do with Reagan's connection to a mob lawyer named Sidney Korshak and MCA, Universal's, involvement with the mafia. And he makes a pretty convincing case that the mob was definitely involved with the Gipper. Yeah. Believe it or not.
We may have had some other presidents who had mob support.
Well, yes, we have had. Richard Nixon was the most mobbed up president we've ever had. Donald Trump has always been mobbed up. I mean, I don't think that's even a controversial thing to say. And LBJ had mob connections as well. I mean, the mafia is an extremely powerful organization.
And you're not worried in publishing these books about the mob?
I personally am not worried about the mob, no.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me on.
Mark Crispin Miller is a professor of media studies at NYU. And he has curated a series published by Open Road Media called Forbidden Bookshelf. And you should check those books out. Thank you so much
Thank
for being
so
on our
much.
Show.
Thanks for having me on, Leonard. I appreciate it.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Mark Crispin Miller, to Barbara Kahn, who produced this segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lent.
Leonard Lopate and Large comes to you
on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.